Montreal's municipal election is one. Prochain Montréal on their way out. But Soraya Martinez-Ferrada hasn't taken up shop at City Hall yet. What can Montrealers expect when she does? Well, for the remainder of today's show, you're going to hear in depth about her promises when it comes to an issue on everyone's minds: housing and rising rents. Martinez-Ferrada has committed to approving all housing projects that have already been submitted but remain stalled within her first 100 days in office. And her administration plans to add incentives and reduce regulations with the goal of encouraging private development. But while she's putting a few new measures on the books for renters, some of the biggest asks from tenants groups are not among them. Now, CKUT went looking for two voices who can speak to these different perspectives: housing supply on the one hand, and tenants' rights on the other. At first, we have Dr. Richard Schirmer, a professor of urban planning at McGill. He speaks to the limited powers that the city has at its disposal and whether an ensemble administration could actually help the affordable housing crisis. Here's our conversation. Housing emerged as one of the big issues in this municipal election. If you look at the headlines, the monthly rent you'll see for a two-bedroom apartment is up by more than 70% since 2019. Rental vacancies are low, especially when it comes to affordable apartments, so a new administration will face big challenges. And before we get into the nuts and bolts of what Ensemble Montréal is promising, I just want to hear from you in this context, looking at the policy platform, the promises that they've put out, looking at the vision that they have for housing, what do you think that Ensemble Montréal sees as the root of the housing crisis that we're facing, and generally the kind of strategy they're putting forward to fix it?
I'm not sure I can speak to where they see the root of the problem being, but they are shifting emphasis. They are focusing less on regulation and more on the financial side. How can developers, which can be nonprofits as well, how can they raise the money to get their developments out of the ground? And I do get the impression that the Plante administration was less focused on that. The philosophy behind the 2020 was more of a coercive, you know, in order to build, you must do this. Whereas the Soraya Martinez-Ferrada's approach, at least from what I've read on paper, is more, how can we incentivize developers, not just private sector, but also nonprofits, to develop?
You know, Martinez-Ferrada and various candidates have talked about the crisis of, you know, just no new buildings being built in Montreal. And they've pointed to housing starts. Data shows that they saw a steep decrease almost by half from 2021 to 2023. If you look at the CMHC, there's been some recovery since then. And, you know, they've put forward a few measures, a few promises to, you know, make it easier for people to build in the city. And, you know, I want to talk about those measures in a second. But first, you know, looking at the housing crisis we're seeing in Montreal, how much of that would you say is a crisis of supply, is a crisis of private development just being unable to make it work here?
I think that there definitely are two housing crises, at least two housing crises. One is a general problem of supply. As you said, you know, building permits have gone down at a time when there has been a lot of immigration. There's also, when you look at the household formation data, there's a sort of suppressed household formation. People are staying longer in their homes. So people who may otherwise have the money, were housing a bit more affordable, they could still afford market housing, are actually not being able to move out either of their parents' homes or the small apartments that they're in. So there is a need for just more building to fluidify the market housing, which would inevitably bring the prices down. I mean, it should. But that's for people who have decent incomes and who can afford it. So there is a problem for the middle classes. And they, you know, kids who have jobs find it difficult to move out. That's not the same thing as the problem of people on very low incomes. That's a separate problem. People on very low incomes, whatever the market price, are not going to be able to get into the market simply because their incomes are very low. Now, this is linked to a wider problem that obviously can't be solved in the city, of rising income inequalities. There are now more and more people who are working full-time who just don't have a living wage, basically. Now, how do these people find somewhere to live? Or even people who have a small wage but have a family to look after and things like that. So The affordable housing crisis is for people on the low end of the income spectrum. What can we do for them? That's where the government needs to step in, and also where the city of Montreal has maybe fairly limited capacity to do things. Why is it limited? Because if these people have lower incomes, there needs to be a top-up from somewhere. We need to build buildings which are more than they can afford and allow them to occupy them at a price that they can afford, and who pays for that difference? Now, the city of Montreal and all municipalities across Canada, but particularly in Quebec, are faced with a financial issue. They just don't have the money. The only way they can raise money is through property taxes, and they've more or less maxed that out. So cities are not in a position to pay that differential between what it costs to build a building and what poorer people can afford. That's why we need provincial and federal intervention, who have income taxes, who have corporate taxes, who can raise money. And these are the corporations benefiting from these low wages, to actually then shovel some of that back into housing. The city, all it can really do is what the mayor has already said that she will be looking at, is seeing to what extent the city can use its own real estate, its own properties, to maybe hand over land at a very low cost or on very long leases. There are some rules about when city sells land, it's not the same as when they lease it. So there are good reasons to lease it, because you don't have to look at the sales rules. But also, the great thing about long leases is that in 70 years' time, Montreal will get that land and those houses back into their own portfolio again. So that's about all the city can do to reduce the costs. But often that's not enough. Land, particularly when you're building high density, is not the most expensive part. It's actually putting the buildings up, which costs a lot of money, and that you will need some intervention. But raising money to subsidize housing, the city has very limited capacity to do that, hence the need for the provincial and federal intervention, which is out of the city's power to determine.
I mean, and it's also been a subject of critique in recent years. We've seen the CAC switch from a social housing fund to an affordable housing fund, an affordable housing incentivizer accelerator that has sought private projects opposed to a traditional public approach to the problems of social and affordable housing. At the federal level, we've seen a lot of housing investments, but a smaller percentage of that towards social, affordable co-op housing than you might expect, given, you know, the public nature of these investments. You know, coming back to, you know, what the city can do within that climate, you said, well, one of the things it can do is incentivize and make it easier for people to build within Montreal. And that might have trickle down effects, maybe not for low income tenants, but for other tenants on the market. You know, when I hear that kind of argument, I also sometimes hear a response and people say, well, you know, there actually are vacancy rates for new builds that are expensive, right? Like if this was going to work, if supply would actually move middle class and upper middle class people towards these new builds, why are we seeing such higher vacancy rates in recent builds? What do you think about that kind of response?
Okay, I think that there's two issues with the current oversupply in some segments of the market. A lot of the oversupply is in very small units, which are very expensive. And people are looking at that and saying, well, we don't want them. So the developers have misread, actually, the market in some cases. And also, a lot of the development has been towards the upper end. So even within market building, you can build at the high end or you can build at the lower end of the market. It's been rather high end market, and that's saturated. It doesn't mean that at the lower end, there are people who can still afford market rates, but they can't afford luxury condos. They find themselves bereft. So yes, there is an issue there of the type of supply. I mean, housing markets are very segmented by geography, by housing type, by incomes. And some of those segments can be dealt with by the private sector, but they can sometimes over-deliver in one segment and less in another. And some of those segments are actually dealt with, can only be dealt with by the public sector.
Yeah, I guess that brings me to some of the concrete promises that Ensemble Montréal has made when it comes to incentivizing development, because they take aim at Projet Montréal's kind of keystone policy to incentivize social and affordable housing both, which is the 2020 bylaw, which you mentioned up top. So that bylaw sought to make developers build 20% social, 20% affordable, 20% family housing in certain new builds or pay a fine. And basically, almost everybody paid the fine. And it's a policy that's been critiqued across the board. Martinez-Ferrada said, Ensemble Montréal, we're going to get rid of it. It's not working and it's making it hard for people to build. On top of that, she wants to incentivize development. She wants to cut down permit wait times, axe certain zoning regulations. You know, this is a broad swath of changes. And, you know, critics are saying, well, what impact is that going to have on these lower segments of the market who can't afford the same as these new builds that you're putting forward? What do you make of these specific policy changes? What impact are they going to have on Montreal's housing market?
First of all, I think we need to be careful not to overemphasize the differences between the Plante and the new administration. Because yes, of course, there have been elections, so a lot of focus has been on criticizing the others. But actually, I was quite surprised when I went through the program of the new mayor that, you know, there is a lot of attention has been given to housing and to homelessness. And there is a genuine set of ideas to actually try and tackle that. Now, you could imagine somebody coming in who is totally different from Plante saying, we don't care about housing anymore, let the market solve it. That's not at all the new mayor's approach. So I think, first of all, we've got to realize that whatever differences we're talking about are not huge. So the 2020 program is an example of what is called inclusionary zoning. So this is a zoning law which says if you want to build somewhere, you have to have 20% social, 20% affordable. That's what it was in Montreal. Typically in North America, and there's quite a few of these sorts of inclusionary zoning, it's about 20 to 25% social or affordable housing. So Montreal went for quite a significantly higher percentage than what we've seen across the rest of North America, but the principle is fairly similar. But the big difference is that where these policies work, it's not just asking the developer to include social or affordable housing. It's saying you must include it, but in return, you get something for it. And why do developers need something in return? Because it's an extra risk. If they are building a large building, which they know they're not going to make a huge amount of money off, that needs to be offset by something. If it's not offset, a developer will go and look elsewhere. And even if the developer wants to look at it, their finances, you know, the developer needs to raise money. The people financing will say, no, it's too risky. We can't finance you. We can't back you if you have to put 40% of social affordable housing. So where this sort of policy does work, it's where the cities have said, right, you put in 20 or 25% social housing, but in return, you can build two or three extra floors. You get more density. So that way, the extra risk is offset by the fact that the developer can build more more building. They can sort of build higher or more units or however it's measured. And that's what the new mayor is proposing. And that's what was missing from 2020. A lot of the critiques, at least from the developers' side, were, look, yes, the percentages are quite high, but critically, there's nothing in it for us. Why would we do that when we can just go and build in Longueuil or go and build in Montreal West or wherever without all this hassle? If then what's being done now is to say, you need to include some social housing, and I haven't seen exactly what proportion of social housing is going to be imposed, but my understanding is that there will be some obligations on developers, but in return for those obligations, they will get more density. They will be able to build more. And to be frank, I think that that will actually probably get more affordable and social housing built than the sort of the firmer approach of Valérie Plante. But by being so firm, it has discouraged developers. And if there's something in it for developers, they may come and build. Yes, they'll build more market housing, but we'll also have more social and affordable housing. And that's the whole point from a policy perspective. In a way, you don't want to sort of cut off your nose to spite your face. You don't want to say, well, we refuse to give developers anything. Fine. They'll say, well, you'll get absolutely nothing.
Did you see incentives for social and affordable housing? Because I saw it just that she was going to replace it with some kind of incentive program, but I didn't see any more details than that.
It wasn't written in black and white, but for me, it was in the same paragraph as where 2020 was talked about. So for me, it was just a more of the way they constructed their sentences rather than, you know, for me, those incentives have got to be for something. If those are incentives just to build, then of course it's a problem.
We'll definitely have to see because, you know, this is also like, these are the promises. We don't know what's actually going to make it into practice. But you mentioned something which was interesting, which is just, let's not overstate the differences between the two parties here. And one area that I've seen some people take that approach is with Airbnbs. And there's been headlines that I've seen circulating that, you know, Soraya Martinez-Ferrada wants to relax restrictions on Airbnbs. Then you go and read other people and they say, well, there's not that much of a difference between the two approaches. What do you know about what is actually going to change with the regulations around short-term rentals? Because obviously we've seen them be a big problem in Montreal, and people said that they have a significant impact on the price of rent, even though maybe it's marginal. Marginal things can still have an impact in these areas. What is she actually proposing here that's having some people up in arms and other people saying, well, I don't really see the change?
Well, I can't see much change. My understanding from having read her platform is that she will be banning Airbnb, but individuals will have the possibility to rent their accommodation for 90 days in a year. It's saying no to Airbnb and then relaxing that and saying individuals, which was the spirit of Airbnb in the first place. However, the key difference is enforcement. She is saying, I'm going to actually increase the number of inspectors from 3 to 50 and genuinely go around enforcing this, which I think is very important. Now, you know, there may be budgetary reasons why Valérie Plante didn't do it. So I'm not saying that this is, because I don't think Valérie Plante was particularly enamored to Airbnb. But one of the very positive proposals is to say, we're going to put inspectors on the ground. And she mentioned giving them the right tools. And part of her platform is negotiating with the province of Quebec to allow inspectors to have certain sort of powers to actually then enforce, because that's one of the big problems, is that Airbnb regulation is, or licensing, is a provincial thing. And what can a municipal officer do if a provincial license is missing? So there needs to be more powers given to the city to actually enforce. And I think that, you know, I'm not trying to critique Valérie Plante. This is a new thing. You know, the Valérie Plante was an administration that had to deal with this new type of occupation. She did her best. And now someone's coming on with a set of new ideas which will further what Valérie Plante is doing. So I'm hesitant to put them present this as a battle between them. I think that Valérie Plante and her administration started thinking about regulations. And in fact, many cities have been experimenting over the last 3 or 4 years. There is no sort of recognized way yet to deal with Airbnb. And Soraya Martinez is now taking the next step, which I think is a positive step.
I have heard from some other folks, including your colleague, David Walksmith, who was quoted in one of these articles that, you know, the restriction to only have these short-term rentals operating in the summer was significant because it allowed inspectors to sort of look at any listing that was operating the rest of the year and say, well, you're de facto illegal. Like, it just was a tool to say, oh, we don't have to send this inspection force out on the ground and like try and see, are you dotting your I's and crossing your T's when all this is, you know, requires a lot of provincial collaboration. Do you think that there's any worry there that it's one step forward, two steps back?
Well, it is a different approach. And so she is trying to allow a bit more leeway maybe in terms of dates. And to be frank, David Walksmith is far more specialist on that than I am. So, you know, I think that, you know, what he says definitely carries more weight. But then it's also a question of more what you're trying to do. Are you really trying to stop people doing Airbnb except in summer, or are you saying people have a right to rent out short term and that could happen any time of the year? So, you know, then it becomes, you know, what rights do people have? You know, does it make a difference fundamentally if it's rented out in winter or in summer? It's maybe easier to regulate, but for the individual, provided they respect the 90 days, Why shouldn't they rent it out in winter? So I think that then it enters into a more of a an argument of the basic motivations. Are we allowing people to use their property as they wish with a limit of 90 days? Or are we adding a series of dates which make it easier for us to manage? But really, is that what regulations should be based on? How easy it is for the city to impose them or to sort of implement them and make them be respected? And we'll have to see if it works. But what would have been a difference is to say, Airbnb, we don't want to regulate anymore. Everybody is free to do what they like. That would be fundamental differences, which would be worth going down the streets with placards. What we talk about here are differences in emphasis. That's absolutely true, with which we may or may not agree completely. But these are not fundamental shifts. And I think that this is what really strikes me, is that although they were set up as being very different, and they do have differences in emphasis, I think that at least from the platform, and this is what I'm going on, we will have to see, you know, if we come back next year, we will see what's happening. But from the platform, the differences are definitely there, and we've been speaking about some of them, but they're not fundamental differences, I don't think.
So you're feeling cautiously optimistic, maybe, about this policy on housing? Is that what you would say?
Yeah, cautiously optimistic. I think that some of the blockages which have become evident as 2020 was being implemented over the last few years are being dealt with. More importantly, I think, there has been a certain reluctance on the part of the Plant administration to really open dialogues with developers and people who are building. And this is for understandable reasons, because back in 2013, there was the Charbonneau Commission. There was a lot of suspicion of corruption. And I think there's a legitimate suspicion to have. And one of the consequences of that was for municipalities, particularly Montreal, to pull back from really negotiating with developers. It's developers just have to sort of present their plans and then planners will accept them or not. But it's far more helpful if there can be a more constructive engagement so that developers understand what planners are looking for, planners understand some of the constraints developers are under, so that if there's that dialogue can occur, then the projects which are put forward are likely to be better projects.
It's funny because I've heard the opposite from like housing committees, you know, tenants' rights groups on the ground. They say, you know, if the city was using really the tools it has at its disposal in a more strict way, using its right of first refusal more, using like tougher penalties when people don't build social and affordable housing targets, then we wouldn't be in this mess. But they're being too cozy with developers is the critique I've heard.
The problem of that approach is it doesn't really take into account, you know, like it or not, we're in a private markets society, and like it or not, developers will raise money and build. So if you only apply coercion and penalize them, they will stop building. And this is not a threat, it's just how the market works. So we may not like the market society we're in, but we are in a market society, and therefore, if you just use the stick, developers will say, well, and the money behind developers will go elsewhere. So
So you're saying, you know, we have to be a little bit more like Toronto or Vancouver or risk all the development going there. Isn't that exactly what we're trying to avoid?
Well, in order to avoid it, we have to have a genuine dialogue, because by frightening developers off, by saying, look, really, we're going to impose so many conditions that it's going to be impossible to build, developers will say, right, we're not going to build. And then what? Then nobody's got anything. I can understand why people fighting for tenants' rights are very frustrated, and because there is a genuine issue. But I get the feeling that this idea that there's a huge pot of money out there and all we need to do is to be more firm and we're going to get that pot of money to be spent how we want it is just not how the current market system works. Now, two things. Either we have a revolution and we get rid of the market system, which may be great, but it's not going to happen tomorrow. In the meantime, what do we do? And I think in the meantime, before everything is perfect and we have a complete socialist state, we need to work with developers. Say, we understand how the development process works, understand how money is raised, and see if we can get them, by giving them some incentive, so at least we don't increase their risk, we don't increase their costs. An incentive is not necessarily giving them a free ride. It's just saying, we're asking something from you and we're going to compensate you. for what you do. But in return, we're going to get our 20% or 25% social housing. Now, is it better to get that social housing or to get nothing? And I think that's a question which people who are asking to sort of apply regulations, be more strict, have got to think about. In the same way, right of first refusal. That's great, but where does the city get the money to buy that property? You can only...
Well, Plante had, what was it, 500 million over 10 years. They have used that. The problem they've run into is like the city buys it and then there's no money from the province or the feds for groups to develop it.
I think that, so first of all, on the few times that they have bought these buildings, then it's a question of getting money from the outside. But in order to really address the housing issue, they will need to be doing that every second week. They just don't, the city just doesn't have the money. They have the right, and this is one of the examples of the rights the province has given them, but actually the right doesn't mean very much unless you have the money to back it. So yes, the city has bought a few buildings. Remember that the right of first refusal, they have to buy at market rate. So they have to sometimes buy very, very expensive buildings, which then they'll make a loss on because they want to develop it as social housing. So the groups who put forth this as a solution have got to think it through. And when you start thinking it through, we say in some particular cases, it may be useful. If there's a particular site that's strategically important, or if there's a really good deal that can be had. But as a general way of addressing the housing problem, it just means the city needs more money. And we get back to what we were talking about before. Where is that money going to come from?
Or they need to be able to expropriate.
But without paying any compensation. And that's then going to be another sort of issue, which brings us back to the reality of our market system. Right now, expropriation is not part of what's acceptable in a market society. And I think that this is where, you know, we have to be, I think when we address a housing crisis, we have to be pragmatic. And I know that there are a number of militants who actually do want to fundamentally change the system. And to some extent, I sympathize, but to some extent, I think it's not pragmatic if we really want to get houses built in a market system over the next 10 years.
From talking to them, I think they want to change what is seen as common sense. What would you say to that? Like, we're talking within the existing system, I think. Yeah. What's going to make sense? What's not going to make sense? But the role of a politician sometimes is also to change what we think of as possible. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's hard to do at the municipal level. Maybe that's an impossible task. Absolutely. Here, but is there any room for a municipal politician to look at the housing crisis and say, okay, maybe we are competing with other markets for getting things built. Maybe we are faced with so many constraints and so little money. Is there any wiggle room that you see as somebody who's thinking very pragmatically? Is there anything that makes you think, okay, maybe I'll shift my pragmatism just this once?
The problem is that the pragmatism involves accepting the wider world as it is and trying to work within it. So I can try to shift my pragmatism, but I can't shift the wider world. So in other words, my pragmatism isn't going to shift because the very essence of pragmatism is to take into account the wider world. When you're a municipality or municipal actors, it's all the more difficult to assume the wider world away because the actors, in particular the developers and the financiers, they can just get up tomorrow and go and work somewhere else. So we have to work within those constraints. If the idea is to sort of change the system, then at the very least, that's got to work at the provincial or federal level. So we need to sort of, or the people who want these changes, would need to vote in an NDP government who wants massive change and then start from there. In the meantime, a municipality within that wider system has got to take that wider system as given. Otherwise, nothing will happen, which is worse than sort of being pragmatic and getting a little bit.
Well, we'll see what happens within that limited range of possibilities. But thank you so much for speaking to me. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
For CKUT, I'm Jules Bijel with the Local Journalism Initiative.